This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 46 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frueling. Today we're going to be joined by Duncan Barrett to talk about his new book, Star Trek, The Human Frontier, and the Concept of Exceptionalism. Zachary, how are you today?
I'm excited to have Duncan on the show. It's been some time we've been trying to get Duncan on the show, but we've had a hard time coordinating. You know, we've got the distance overseas, the time zone difference, and it's been a busy couple weeks for me and for you. So I'm glad we finally were able to circle the proverbial wagons and get Duncan on the show.
Well, managing, you know, warp drive across the pond, that has been a bit of a challenge, but we finally made it happen. And I just received a hail, Zachary. Duncan is ready to come aboard the Starship of Theseus, so Energizer Chief. Duncan, welcome aboard the Starship of Theseus. It is fantastic to have you here on Metatrex today.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
As many of our listeners know, Duncan Barrett is a writer and author. His latest book, Star Trek: The Human Frontier, has just been released. We're going to talk about that today. Duncan is no stranger to many of our listeners who follow us on the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. Duncan is a frequent visitor to the Babel Conference, posting and commenting on various threads. So, again, we're glad to have you aboard. Looking forward to talking about Star Trek: The Human Frontier. I've been reading it, and it's fantastic. I know Zachary's gotten a copy of it. He's been reading it as well. We're going to talk about that a little bit today, but I'm actually looking forward to the conversation regarding exceptionalism in Star Trek.
Yeah, that should be interesting. I think exceptionalism, it's a topic that is maybe in one throwaway line in the book. So I've had to do a bit of thinking since Zachary suggested it for this show. But I think it should be an interesting conversation, hopefully.
I think the discussion of exceptionalism is sort of the necessary flip side of the coin when you're talking about the human condition. Mm-hmm. You know, Star Trek in general is ultimately, regardless of any other philosophical topics that Star Trek raises, it's ultimately about us as humans and our place in the universe and who we are and what we could become. And the flip side of that is, well, what kind of being are we? Are we a truly exceptional kind of being, either here on our own planet or out in the galaxy somewhere, if there are other alien species? What is our position in relation to the universe, other species, to species on our own planet? And do we have any sort of unique qualities that makes us a unique kind of being, as opposed to just one amongst the countless beings that are either here on our own planet or elsewhere in the cosmos? So I don't think you can avoid at least raising the issue of exceptionalism given human abilities whenever you're talking about the human condition.
Sure, I think that makes a lot of sense. And certainly thinking about humans in the real world on Earth, you know, in many respects, people would say we're exceptional compared to the other animals. On the other hand, there's a kind of movement, for example, the use of the term earthlings, to try and draw attention to the idea that actually, you know, maybe we shouldn't be seeing ourselves as superior in a way to the rest of the world, and coming from a kind of environmental perspective or a kind of animal welfare or animal rights perspective, there's a kind of argument that, you know, really, I suppose all kinds of exceptionalism carry with them a certain danger. And in terms of the real world, and that kind of exceptionalism of humans towards other species, it carries a great environmental danger.
Well, I think there's two separate issues as it relates to exceptionalism. One is just the more fundamental question is, are we even exceptional in any regard? Do we in fact have a higher degree of consciousness or a higher degree of knowledge or a higher degree of abilities compared to other species? And Star Trek really does push back on this. I'm thinking of things like Star Trek IV, when we learn about the, you know, intelligence mm-hmm. and the communication mm-hmm. yeah. abilities of whales, right? Star Trek, even on our own planet, tries to say maybe our rational faculties are not as superior as we like to think they are. So that's one part of the discussion. I think another part is, given that, what are the ethical implications of that? Are those rational faculties the kinds of things that convey ethical responsibilities, or is ethics grounded in something altogether different, like the ability to feel pleasure and pain, or something else, right? But so I think it's hard, because I think you kind of want to jump right into talking about the ethics, but I think it's not obvious at all that ethics should be grounded in rational ability. I think some philosophers like Kant.
Kant!
Have argued that it's relating to other people as co-rational agents that conveys our moral and ethical responsibility to them. But other philosophers like utilitarians have argued that it's the ability to suffer or feel pain, which is shared by any number of species, not just the intelligent ones, not just the communicative smart ones, that conveys ethical responsibility. So those are interesting two parts of the discussion. I think I'd like to kind of start with the beginning and just spend some time talking about humans mm-hmm. and either here on our own planet or out in the galaxy. You know, what about humans? Are we as superior? Do we have unique abilities like we tend to think we do? And what does Star Trek have to say about this? Does Star Trek make any overall claims about the uniqueness of humans either on our own planet or out in the galaxy?
Well, I think Star Trek tends to present humans as special as compared to the other kind of alien races that are encountered, certainly the races that are encountered on a regular basis. I'm thinking maybe the most sort of crystallized example of this that springs to mind for me is Observer Effect, the Enterprise episode, where you have the Organians who are studying the various species, and they mention, you know, the Klingons, the Cardassians, they mention these other species that we're familiar with. And the experiment that they're conducting, you know, basically they discover something from it, which is that humans behave differently from essentially every other species that they've encountered. And consistently in Star Trek, what it is that is different about humans, or one of the things that's different about humans, but the thing that is picked up in that episode is this idea of compassion. And you see that, I suppose, going right back to the Corbomite maneuver, right back to, you know, some of the very earliest Star Trek ever made. It's that kind of compassion for your enemy, compassion helping people. On the other hand, you know, so you have this system where the defining feature of humans, the defining feature of the Federation, in a sense, is a kind of compassionate sensibility compared to these other species. And yet, what's the most fundamental guiding principle of the Federation? It's the Prime Directive, which is consistently opposed to compassion. And obviously in Enterprise, we learn that the Prime Directive essentially is kind of a Vulcan legal imposition, in a sense. And so obviously in a lot of those Enterprise episodes, I'm thinking of Dear Doctor or, I don't know, Cogenitor or some of these other moral dilemma episodes, you have exactly this kind of conflict between human compassion and a kind of principle of trying to hold back from that.
I guess a question that comes to my mind is, insofar as Star Trek presents humans as exceptional in this regard, exceptionally compassionate, say, compared to the Klingons or Romulans, is that exceptionalism something innate to human nature? Is there sort of an essentialism to that that presentation of humans? Humans are essentially more compassionate, or is that something that is contingent, you know, as a result of, you know, the unique strand of human development that occurred historically, but contingently, to the point where, you know, Klingons could become more compassionate, Romulans could become more compassionate. They just have a development path. It's not that humans are essentially superior to any of these other species. We happen to have cultivated certain virtues historically in universe. But is that the kind of thing that is Star Trek basically saying? Klingons and Romulans, you know, will reach our stage of development at a certain point, or are we essentially better than they are?
My feeling is that there is a kind of there is something a bit more essential than that. There is a kind of species tendency. On the other hand, I mean, another way of looking at it is obviously we are seeing these exceptional people. You know, even in terms of Star Trek's Earth, in terms of the Federation, you know, we're seeing not only people who are in Starfleet, so they have a certain kind of philosophical attitude which informs that, but also kind of the best of the best for the most part. You know, if you think, I mean, Captain Kirk in the Corbomite Maneuver, or, you know, I suppose Captain Picard maybe in the Enterprise D crew, they're the kind of epitome of these kind of evolved, almost perfected human beings. I mean, that was a big part of the development of the Next Generation, was this idea of moving beyond all these kind of foibles and conflict and these various issues. And they really, they are these kind of perfect humans in a sense. But that's not necessarily to say that all human beings have reached that level. And of course, we see examples, you know, increasingly. I mean, another way of looking at this would be that as Star Trek moved on through the 90s, going forward, you know, through time in Deep Space Nine, obviously a lot of these things were kind of questioned. There's that speech that Quark gives in The Siege of AR-558, where he says, basically, if you take away the creature comforts, the humans are no different from Klingons. You know, so that, in a sense, it is contingent. It's contingent on having created this utopian future society, in a sense, which allows people to behave in that way. And you see that even, you know, you get this sense. I mean, if you think of First Contact, for example, there's this, when Picard invokes this idea of the evolved sensibility, but it's immediately shot down. You know, Lily basically proves it's bullshit. And you get the same thing in Deep Space Nine. Miles O'Brien in Hard Time, he says, you know, we were brought up to believe these things about human beings, but when it came down to it, I didn't behave in line with those ideals. So there is a sort of idea, I suppose, after Gene Roddenberry's death anyway, that this evolved human sensibility might be a bit of a myth, and that maybe people have bought into it a bit too much. But, you know, you scratch the surface, or you change the conditions of the kind of geopolitics, and it starts to crumble.
Do these evolved sensibilities, you know, that are referred to, do they serve the same kind of role that, say, Plato's Republic served from a political philosophy standpoint, maybe establishing some sort of utopian ideal that people will inevitably fall short of, but the mere fact that humans have lofty ideals, a la Star Trek ideals, does that itself give us, you know, place us in some sort of higher sensibility, just the mere fact that we have ideals that are, you know, I think Star Trek is not neutral about this. Star Trek would say these are better ideals than the ideals of the Klingon Empire, the ideals of the Romulan Empire, right? Even if case by case by case, each individual human, you know, inevitably falls short because, you know, like you said eloquently, you know, the ideals are somewhat bullshit, as Lily points out to Captain Picard. People fall short, but is it a good thing that we have those ideals, however much we fall short? Does that itself make the human or Federation ideals exceptional amongst the field of other ideals that other empires have?
Well, if you ask Captain Janeway, she'll tell you that the ideals are what actually, you know, enable their survival, in a sense. There's that speech she gives quite early on in Voyager, isn't there, where they've been sort of flirting with a degree of compromise in their dealings with the Kazon, and it all goes horribly wrong, and there's a kind of bloodbath. And she says, are these the principles, the ideals of the Federation are the strongest allies we could have, you know, counterintuitively, in a sense, because she is in this situation where you might expect her to bend the rules a bit, to kind of not be like Picard in his situation. This kind of, you know, he's in some ways in a safer position to occupy the moral high ground. And yet she consistently...
She could have turned into Captain Ransom.
Right? Yeah, well, exactly. That's the danger. And you see how easily it happens for her, actually, because in Equinox, as soon as she... almost the fact of seeing this other ship, she becomes infected with this kind of moral relativism herself, because she then resorts to this kind of torture, effectively. She loses Chakotay's support, she loses Tuvok's support. And, you know, Janeway is the kind of arch-idealist, and yet all it takes is this kind of horrific view, I suppose, of another path that her and her crew could have gone down. And it clearly affects her dramatically. It has some kind of deep... it's like a loss of faith, I suppose. And I guess that's another way of looking at this question. You know, what you see in First Contact, this idea of this evolved sensibility, is it true, is it bullshit, or whatever. One of the things that kept coming to my mind when we were you know, when we were talking previously about this topic, is the speech from Hamlet that Picard quotes to Q quite early on in The Next Generation, "What a piece of work is a man." And one of the things that's kind of interesting about that speech is that Picard quotes it without irony. So he quotes it as if he's kind of completely bought into this idea. Now, actually, the situation in Hamlet is a lot more complicated than that. There is this kind of soaring rhetoric. There is this kind of elevated concept of a man. And the idea, the words that are expressed, they do apply very strongly, in a sense, to Picard and the Next Generation crew. You know, in action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. These are the kind of things that an alien species of a less technologically sophisticated race, that is how they would see the Enterprise. You know, they are going around doing good work like an angel. They do have an apprehension, an understanding of the universe, which is far more complicated, which is, you know, more technologically sophisticated. They have a better understanding of science, etc. So in some ways, it's not surprising that Picard should buy into this, but it kind of ignores the fact that in Hamlet, you know, what Hamlet is saying is, okay, I know I should believe all of this, but I can't because of his mental state and so on. He says, you know, but to me, what is this quintessence of dust? And then to go even further, he undermines it with a kind of cheap sexual innuendo. He ends by saying, "Man delights not me, no, nor woman neither, though by your smiling you seem to say so," because either Rosencrantz or Guildenstern is obviously smirking at him. So I suppose in some ways that's kind of indicative of the Next Generation position, consciously or not. I don't know whether whoever wrote that episode was in a sense misreading the context of that speech, was just selecting and editing, but it must have been interesting for Patrick Stewart. Obviously, as a Shakespearean actor, he would have had a kind of appreciation of the kind of broader context there. So I wonder if on some level there is a sense of the slight blinkeredness of that kind of, you know, Roddenberry's box, as they called it, of this kind of mindset that TNG was in, of kind of, you know, they've drunk the Kool-Aid and they're not questioning it. And it takes a few years, and it takes probably after Roddenberry's death, to get to this point where later Star Trek is sort of beginning to chip away at this, you know, and obviously in First Contact, maybe that's the most striking example for Picard of when that kind of confidence in those ideals begins to disintegrate.
You mentioned Captain Janeway. She mentions often that the principles of the Federation are guiding principles. And I think it's really interesting and really underappreciated the way in Equinox Chakotay's character has evolved. He's gone from someone who doesn't always want to do things kind of above board. He's the one that's usually more willing to compromise, more willing to bend the rules. And yet here he is starkly opposed to Captain Janeway, who he more or less feels is crossing a line. And he questions her, he calls her on it. And so I see how those principles in practice have really changed his moral character over the course of the series. You mentioned the Organians previously. And I think throughout Star Trek, there's no doubt that humanity is presented in a way that insinuates that we are, as a species, exceptional. However, Star Trek kind of waffles on that principle. I'm thinking of Errand of Mercy, the other episode from the original series in which we see the Organians, in which the Federation and humanity really, in contrast, are not much different from the Klingons. We're bloodthirsty, we're ready to go to war, and it takes the superior wisdom of the Organians to put a stop to it. Oftentimes in Star Trek, characters, even main characters, human characters, are presented to be very Machiavellian, and you know, they're conniving, they're scheming, they're compromising. So I wonder, Duncan, as you think about these contrasting pictures of humanity, do you suppose that Star Trek itself is not sure how we fit in terms of our own exceptionalism?
Well, I suppose there's, you know, obviously there's a big aspect of it that episodes are written by different people and they necessarily encode different assumptions and different ideas. I think it's true. I mean, if you look at the original series, I suppose there was, I mean, you mentioned Errand of Mercy, also A Private Little War. There is a kind of cynicism mm-hmm. there to some extent and a kind of a slightly depressed I'm just thinking, you know, Private Little War, there's a kind of crushing cynicism to that in a sense. And I suppose maybe that does change by the time of The Next Generation, though. But I guess, so you can point to these kind of changes. I suppose we might say TNG is the kind of high point of that kind of confidence and of the kind of Roddenberry's box and of the kind of this sort of positive belief. And then it gets sort of chipped away again. But I guess also you see things that work in different directions. I mean, part of the issue, I suppose, is that when we're dealing with Star Trek, often we are dealing with something that is kind of close to allegory. There's a degree of metaphor. It's, you know, obviously we can take it on one level as a sort of, you know, a fictional story that is consistent and is within its own terms true. But at the same time, you know, what are these different species representing? I mean, the kind of classic other races in Star Trek are, they're simplified to an extent. You know, I mean, in one of your early episodes, you talked about this in terms of virtue ethics, you know, the Klingon honour, the Vulcan logic, the Ferengi acquisitiveness and so on. They are kind of simplified aspects of real world human beings. And there's a kind of acknowledgement of this almost even within Star Trek in Enterprise when Ambassador Saval tells Admiral Forrest, we don't know what to make of humans because they have all these conflicting qualities. You know, they can be logical one minute, they can be wrathful the next. And really what he's saying is they are actual human beings as opposed to these kind of simplified aspects of you know, real humanity, which is kind of the model for making those different alien races in Star Trek. So I suppose it depends what does being human represent in Star Trek. Is it literally just a biological fact of, you know, this species, in the same way as we might say what is it to be a cat or what is it to be a dog in the real world? Or is there sort of something more in there? Is there something more metaphorical? What does it represent? And I think for me, in terms of the issue of exceptionalism, when I watch Star Trek, I am completely absorbed in this kind of idea of, you know, humans are best, humans are have these noble qualities. You know, I can kind of sign up to that. It's quite inspiring in some ways. But at the same time, really what it means to be human in Star Trek a lot of the time is to be democratic, to be liberal, to be, you know, it's this other set of values which aliens landing on Earth would not necessarily say these are the values of Earth. They're, I suppose, in some sense, they're sort of American values. They're kind of enlightened Western values to a certain extent. So it's possible to kind of sign up for that and to sign up to Star Trek's humanism, where that kind of represents a certain sort of philosophical, political, they're secular typically, view, which might be different to the real world where, you know, for me personally, if I think about humans in relation to other species on Earth in the real world, as opposed to other fictional species out in space, I'm not sure that I do have such a confidence in terms of human superiority, at least when we're talking about moral superiority. Obviously, humans are technologically far superior or far more developed than other species. And we, you know, we have a kind of control over the world and so on. But I think there's a big question as to whether that gives us a kind of right to use other species as we please, or a responsibility to take care of them or to take care of the world and not to cause damage. Because obviously, you know, compared to any other species on Earth right now, humans have the greatest capacity for doing harm, in a sense. And I'm not sure that some of the ideas that we have, that we are morally superior to other beings because we have philosophy, because we can have podcasts and discuss these issues, and obviously cats and dogs can't, are necessarily true. And, you know, research actually suggests that to a certain extent, there's a degree of kind of human chauvinism in all this, because obviously it's hard to know what ethical qualities other animals might have. But there have been studies, you know, famously, you see dolphins rescuing people from storms. There have been studies on mice where they showed altruistic behavior. So a lot of these kind of essential ideas that we think make us different from other animals and superior to other animals, in the same way as you might say the humans are superior to the Cardassians or the Klingons or whatever. Actually, again, when you sort of scratch the surface, it's maybe a bit more complicated than it seems at first.
You mentioned the Forge previously, and I know you talked about this in your book, Star Trek, The Human Frontier. You mentioned a moment ago, you referred to it in your book as overriding aspects of the personalities of these alien cultures. In fact, you said many of Star Trek's alien races are defined principally in terms of some overriding aspect of their personalities, whether honor, logic, or acquisition, talking about Klingons, Vulcans, and Ferengi, respectively. But you put a quote in there from Ambassador Saval from the Enterprise episode The Forge, in which he says to Forrest, "We don't know what to do about humans. Of all the species we've made contact with, yours is the only one we can't define. You have the arrogance of Andorians, the stubborn pride of Tellarites. One moment you're as driven by your emotions as Klingons, the next you confound us by suddenly embracing logic." We know that Star Trek is an exploration of the human condition, and certainly those, as you refer to them, overriding aspects of the personalities of these alien races are really windows into our own. Forrest goes on and says, "I'm sure those qualities are found in every species," to which Saval counters, "Not in such confusing abundance." And if humanity really is not alone in the galaxy, certainly these qualities can be found elsewhere. I mean, do you really think that these other species share similar qualities, or are in Star Trek, or are they truly defined by these overriding factors?
Mike, I think this is a great question, and it ties together a couple of threads. I've been taking some notes while you guys have been chatting. One thread that occurred to me is kind of the brilliance of including a race like the Vulcans in the original series. Yeah. You know, humans are very proud to tout our rational faculties, right? This is one of the defining characteristics, one of the things that does distinguish us from other life forms on the planet. We at least have communicative abilities that other species don't seem to have. We seem to reason about things and in ways that other species don't seem to be able to. So there is something exceptional about the human race here on our own planet in terms of those abilities. And as a side note, I remember going to a conference some years ago and listening to Jane Goodall and her work with the great apes. You know, she basically summarized it as saying that other species have the same qualities we do. They reason about things. They help each other. There's an ethical, societal component. But it's a question of degree. It's not a question of kind. Mm-hmm. They have all the same properties we do, but we seem to take them to the nth degree as humans. So I think that if we're looking for any one of those qualities, we can find it elsewhere on our planet and presumably elsewhere in the galaxy if there's life out there as well. But at least in our own world, we seem to take some of those qualities to a higher degree. But the nice thing about including something like the Vulcans is it puts us in our place, right? If we have rational faculties, along come the Vulcans who are better philosophers and better rational agents than we are, right? So they kind of have this diminutive effect on human ability. And when you combine that with other races that you see in Star Trek, combine it with the other casting choices like McCoy representing human emotion, showing the complexity and the tapestry of all these qualities that do make up human nature, it kind of prevents you from relying on any one of those qualities as a definitive, defining, exceptionalistic element of human nature. So I think that's kind of the brilliance of from the very beginning of Star Trek, including alien races, to kind of put humans in their place, put the mirror back at us and say, look, you know, you think you've got all these properties, but you really don't. You know, there might be other species out there that have these properties and qualities to a greater degree than we do. And then balancing that by saying, well, that's okay, because we have emotions and we have these other properties that make up for our deficiencies in any one of those those qualities. Mm. So the true virtue of humanity might be in our balance or our blending of these different elements together.
I think that's definitely true, that there's a kind of emphasis on balance and compromise. I mean, if you think of the Vulcans, yes, there is that kind of, in some ways they are superior. I mean, and it's no coincidence that Spock says that Picard is like a Vulcan, doesn't he? You know, that's his kind of, and that's great praise coming from him. You know, he is this very rational, very reasonable, sort of noble, aspirational figure. I think in terms of what we're talking about this kind of human ideal in the next generation, you know, the two key characters in the next generation are Data, who wants to be human. So he's a kind of, embodying that kind of aspiration, and Picard, who is this kind of perfect human, essentially. On the other hand, you might say that the Vulcans are this kind of idealized, sort of a superior to humans in many respects. They're something to look up to. But consistently, Star Trek sort of works against that because, you know, you see, if you put the Vulcans in charge, everything falls apart. I mean, look at the Galileo 7. Spock is hopeless in command. And even, you know, many years later, by the time of the Wrath of Khan, as soon as the proverbial hits the fan, he hands over to Kirk. You know, it's his best destiny. He should be in charge. The human is the one to do it. And even more so, you see in the third season of Enterprise, because there's this kind of impossible mission, how is this crisis going to be averted? And we see in Twilight, when T'Pol is in charge of the ship, and T'Pol appears to be a very competent captain, she seems to know what she's doing, she doesn't succeed in the mission. The only person who can succeed in that mission is Archer. And it's because of Archer's kind of folksy humanism, I guess you might say, his kind of, you know, he's not an evolved sort of superior intellectual being. He's a very kind of earthy human in a sense. And I think that's wrapped up with his kind of warmth as a character is seen as a big part of his humanism and a big part of his strength. So in season 3 of Enterprise, we see that, ultimately the reason that Archer can complete that mission is because he's willing to make a connection with Degra, and he's willing to forgive him to an extent, and to be sort of diplomatic, and to forge a genuine relationship with someone that it's kind of almost unimaginable to begin with that might be possible. And as we move on into the fourth season of Enterprise, one of the things that I think is quite clever about that season, actually, is that there's always been this kind of question hanging over Star Trek. Why is the Federation... why is Earth so central to the Federation? Why are humans so key to the Federation? We know there are these other founding worlds. We know that the Vulcans are technologically more sophisticated. You know, why is it, as the woman in Star Trek VI says, almost a Homo sapiens only club? Why are they taking the kind of leadership role? And in a sense, Enterprise answers this question in a way that is quite clever, because it kind of both reinforces and undercuts this kind of human exceptionalism, because we see that the reason that the humans play such a pivotal role, even though they're almost a kind of child species compared to some of these others that are more advanced and have been going for longer, is kind of by chance. They're sort of inoffensive. They haven't formed some great feud yet. So you've got, you know, the Vulcans and the Andorians feuding. You've got the Tellarites causing trouble. The humans are kind of inoffensive. They're sort of they're diplomats, but they're diplomats by virtue of not some great brilliant sort of strategic mind or the kind of diplomacy that you might see Picard engaging in, but it's a kind of they can just get everyone around the table, and you know,
they're the project managers,
exactly,
of the Federation, right?
Yeah. And as a result, they end up kind of almost in charge, because they're kind of, they can kind of get on with everyone. That seems to be the impression, doesn't it? They can kind of accommodate different people. They can, they're precisely, I suppose, because they have these, as Saval calls it, you know, these different conflicting aspects of their personality, or as we as viewers might say, because they're real humans rather than, another species which sort of exaggerates one aspect of humanity. They can deal with all these different people with very different agendas. They can be the kind of diplomats in this kind of, you know, future UN scenario, and they can kind of hold the whole thing together.
There's a flexibility to it. I mean, humans are adaptable, and I think this is an amazing truth of human nature. I think, you know, whatever situation you put humans in, we'll find a way to adapt, and we'll find a way to adjust, and we'll keep pushing forward through it all.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, that's the limitation of a lot of the other alien races that you see in Star Trek, is that they, when you think about those kind of virtues that they hold, whether it's logic or honor or whatever, they are a kind of an Achilles heel, in a sense. You know, hence Spock, by the time of Star Trek VI, is saying logic's the beginning of wisdom, not the end. And it's there's a speech in Voyager where Tuvok has done something that Janeway disapproves of, and he says it was logical, and she says, you know, that's logic can be used to justify anything to a certain extent. You know, that's, she says, I think she says that's its strength, and it's also its flaw. And there is a sense that you see repeatedly that if you want to manipulate any of these alien species, it's actually very easy because you just have to play to whatever it is that, you know, everyone knows they consider important. I mean, even Archer in Enterprise can wrap a Klingon around his finger just by, I think he reads in the Vulcan database that Klingons are obsessed with honor, throws in the word honor a few times in what he's saying and gets the Klingon to do what he wants. So it's this kind of... In a way, it's not surprising that the humans should be seen as the successful diplomats, because these other species are blinkered by these specific virtues that they're kind of obsessed with, to the extent that it's kind of easy to trick them into doing what you want.
Plus, we learned that in Deep Space Nine, that if you leave the Vulcans in charge, it leads to very high-stakes baseball games.
Well, yeah, that's true, of course.
Duncan, I think what you're saying is very in line with my own intuitions. I suppose my thoughts earlier were that each of these attributes, these overriding personality aspects of these different species within the Star Trek universe, have limitations. Logic has its limitations. Honor has its limitations. Acquisition has its limitations. And so I think one of the things that really cause humans to stand out, at least in the Star Trek universe, is they embody each of these and all of these. And so when logic comes to its end, and when honor comes to its end, and when diplomacy comes to its end, there's always another attribute to fall back on, always another aspect of our own personalities.
You're essentially saying we're exceptional because we're not.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
we are. We're exceptional because we're not, at least in terms of the Star Trek universe. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's definitely true. And as much as you can point to these kind of specific qualities about humans. I mean, we talked about compassion and this idea that comes up several times, that humans are kind of exceptionally compassionate. There is also this sense that they're exceptional compared to these other species precisely by being an amalgam of all these different conflicting characteristics and attitudes and so on. And I guess you see that in the makeup of the original series, don't you? You know, you've got Spock on one side, you've got McCoy on the other. Kirk is literally this kind of synthesis of these two sides. You see it again in The Enemy Within. You know, he's literally split in two. He has these different aspects to his personality. So I suppose, again, there's this kind of consistent sense that there is a kind of compromise or a kind of a mixture of different conflicting things. There's a kind of melting pot, in a sense. There's a kind of, you know, it's an idea of kind of bringing in different diverse aspects or opinions or philosophies or so on, and kind of being able to cope with that to an extent that maybe is literally alien to some of the other species. I mean, you have your in your intro to the program, you know, as Commander Sisko says, my philosophy is there's room for all philosophies on this station. And that is kind of a core aspect, I suppose, of the humans of Star Trek, of the Federation, is that kind of pluralism, which you don't really get with other species. You know, if there is a difference of opinion on something, it's a separatist group, or, you know, there are Vulcans who don't go along with all the Vulcan teachings, but they're a kind of dangerous splinter group. There isn't a kind of tolerance in most of those other societies of really any deviation from that. You know, you see it with the Ferengi. There's this kind of revolution, in a sense, of kind of a different way of thinking about women, or a different way of thinking about philanthropy or whatever. You know, with the Cardassians, you get this kind of underground movement. With the Romulans, you get this kind of underground movement. So there is a sense that all these other species, they have such a strong sort of governmental, societal structure, that any kind of deviation from that is seen as extremely threatening.
You know, I think you're hitting at what I think of as one of the fundamental tensions in the Star Trek worldview. Because I think you're right. Star Trek generally is not sort of morally agnostic, and it's not neutral about exceptionalism. It does make the claim that humans have, maybe not in any one quality, a superior degree of achievement, but there's something unique about the blend of these characteristics that defines human nature. politically, there is something unique about the Federation compared to the other empires that you see in Star Trek, the Romulan Empire, the Klingon Empire. So the fundamental tension in my mind is kind of simultaneously holding that humans are extra special in some way. The Federation is politically extra special in some way. There's some sort of political exceptionalism. What are, and I think here, to pivot just a little bit, here in our own world, I think, you know, I can relate to this. I feel like, you know, democratic ideals are better than totalitarianism, right?
Sure.
I don't have any qualms at all about saying there's a qualitative betterness to certain kinds of political structures. About human nature, I'm more tentative. I don't feel as strongly about that. But politically, I feel like some types of societies are just better for its people than others. So, and I think you can say that about Star Trek. The Federation, at its best, does better by its citizens than, say, the Klingon Empire or the Romulan Empire does by its citizens. So given that, how do you reconcile this exceptionalism, mainly politically, with this more relativistic, tolerance-based approach that you see, I think, manifesting itself in the Prime Directive, this non-interference policy? So I guess the fundamental question I'm asking is, what are the rights and responsibilities of, you know, someone who's in a position of superiority from an exceptionalist standpoint? If the Federation is a genuinely politically superior society, doesn't it have some sort of obligation to help other societies that it encounters embrace those ideals that it views as qualitatively better? How can you do that without, you know, devolving into colonialism, you know, or taking over other societies wholesale? How do you encourage better virtues and values politically without interfering in a very strong sense? And that's, I think, is just this fundamental tension in the Star Trek worldview. Federation does stand back and say, we're superior in a lot of ways, but we can interfere, but we still wish they would be more like us.
You mean like a Federation definitely recruitment video?
Well, you kind of get that at the end of The Apple, don't you? You get that kind of speech from Kirk to the what are they called? The people with the funny hair and so on. This kind of, you know, it's freedom. It's kind of it is a kind of real Cold War kind of American, you know, impassioned speech for kind of join us in rational, secular, liberal, sexually liberated, 1960s USA. Kind of, that's the model there. So I suppose you do get it there. But generally speaking, it's true. I suppose the Federation is constrained by not imposing its values on other species, however much, you know, we might want them to. And again, you see played out this kind of issue when dealing with other cultures that have some, you know, what we might think of as a superstitious belief, or they have some kind of cultural practice that we don't agree with. I'm thinking, for example, of the man who has to commit suicide when he's 60 years old because that's what his society believes. Or, you know, again, you see with Cogenitor in Enterprise, the kind of, you know, there is that very strong desire to intervene, to help, to, you know, nudge that society in what we would consider the right direction. And yet at the same time, there's this kind of deeply held principle that we mustn't interfere. And I suppose one aspect of that is that, you know, we're given to understand that in Star Trek, the violations of the Prime Directive, however well-intentioned, can have disastrous consequences. You know, that you can't, there is a kind of element of, I mean, it's funny, we were talking about observer effect. It's exactly that kind of thing, that you can't predict the effect that you're going to have. You can't control it to a certain extent. And, you know, people might end up worshipping Federation starships, or they might, it may have unpredicted consequences. So I suppose that's partly where that anxiety comes from. But I think this kind of colonial anxiety is sort of there in the background a lot of the time. I was one of those people, I was slightly disappointed. I actually really enjoyed it. But when Beyond came out in the cinema, having seen that trailer, which had this line about the frontier pushing back, I sort of thought, oh, is this going to engage with this kind of colonial issue about the Federation and kind of touch on that anxiety a bit more, which it rears its head ever so slightly in Star Trek. And then it tends to pop back down. I'm thinking in Enterprise, I think it's either Demons or Terra Prime, the ex-girlfriend of Travis says to him, or he says to her anyway, that she tried to persuade him not to join Starfleet because she saw space exploration as the last vestige of colonial impulse.
You know, I feel like you can kind of blow colonialism out of proportion in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yes, there are these big galactic issues. How much of an impact can you make on an empire? You know, this galactic scale, right? On the other hand, day in and day out, captains in Starfleet encounter situations that walk the fine line between normal cultural practice and morally wrong exploitation. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of something like the Next Generation episode Symbiosis, when, you know, Captain Picard encounters these two species that they've kind of evolved together. You know, it's the episode where there's one of the species is addicted to drugs and the other species is, their whole economy is wrapped around developing this drug. And, you know, basically there's a symbiotic cultural relationship, but it's very exploitative.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've got one of the two species, you know, living in luxury, and the other species is basically, you know, devolved into being drug addicts as a planet. And Captain Picard basically says, you know, this is not normal cultural development. This is exploitation at the end of the day. Mm. And I think it's not always easy to tell the difference. And whenever you see these prime directive violations, I think Starfleet captains are very, very willing to toss the prime directive aside, you know, when they see what they consider to be a case of just outright moral exploitation, not on a galactic scale, but on these individual, you know, episode by episode type of instances. And, you know, what should they do in that situation? Should they just say, not my problem, it's the prime directive, however much we don't like it, we don't intervene? I think the solution at the end of that episode is very interesting by sort of restoring the natural balance, you know, cutting off the transfer of drugs between these two worlds and letting them, you know, returning the sort of quote unquote returning them to their natural evolution without this exploitative relationship. Captain Picard kind of says, I can have my cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
I can plausibly say I'm not interfering and returning them to their natural evolution, and I can feel good about myself that I, you know, help stop this moral exploitation. That's the kind of situation I see Starfleet captains being in every day. You know, they're not willing to just stand back and not intervene
yeah.
in it when they see something that's morally, outright morally corrupt or exploitative.
It is, in a sense, a question of kind of squaring the circle. He has to find a way around or a way of bending the rules, in a sense, so that he can say he's still following the prime directive whilst also, in essence, doing not doing the opposite, but kind of not being constrained by it to the extent that it appears is going to be kind of legally necessary. So I guess there's a lot of kind of that almost is in many of those dilemmas, that's kind of the job of the Starfleet captain, isn't it? Is to find a way of bending the rules in the right way so that they can have their
right.
cake and eat it.
And that's something that I don't see a Vulcan captain doing very well, bending the prime directive. I could see Spock doing that. Spock would say, I didn't tell a lie, exaggerated.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's half human and he's got, you know, human values as well, however much he tries to ignore them. But I can't see a typical Vulcan captain doing that. That's something that a uniquely human Federation captain, as we see in, or Starfleet captain, as we see in Star Trek, could do. Yeah, I don't want to say that because, you know, there are certainly other captains and whatnot. But certainly, I think Star Trek takes the position that humans have the ability to bend the rules when necessary. We can make those practical judgment calls and not be bound by a rule.
So, guys, I want to switch gears for just a moment. Duncan, you mentioned earlier Data, and I want to talk a little bit about Data because in many respects, he's an enigma in Star Trek because he's an artificial life form. In Encounter at Farpoint, he notes to Commander Riker that he is superior to humans in virtually every way. And he says, and yet I'd gladly give it all away to be human. And Commander Riker says to him, it's a pleasure to meet you, Pinocchio. So let's talk a little bit about Data. He is, in all respects, superior, and yet he longs to be human, which by any definition is beneath what he already is and what he's already achieved. Zachary, we were talking in the turbo lift about unification and a conversation that Data and Spock have. Do you want to throw that in there as well?
Well, Mike, my mind goes back to the discussion between Spock and Data in Unification when Spock basically observes about Data that he's been given these exceptional qualities, physical strength, mental discipline, whatnot, and Vulcans have strived their entire lives to be like Data. And Data, you know, counters by saying, you know, you are half human, but yet you've chosen a Vulcan way of life. So you've essentially abandoned what he sought all of his life, you know, trying to be more human-like. So I always thought this idea that Data was superior really didn't ring true to me, right? Yes, he has physical strength. He, insofar as the mind is like a computer, which is a very specious analogy anyway, yes, Data is the epitome of human reason, you know, conceived in this very 20th century way. And in the late 20th century, there was this attempt to try to analyze the human mind like a computer in terms of functional input-output relationships. There's a term for the for that view, functionalism, in philosophy of mind. And I think that's a little out of vogue now compared to say 20 or 30 years ago. But given that, so that always doesn't ring true to me, insofar as that's not a great picture of the human mind, and physical strength doesn't have anything to do with the essential qualities of being a human being. I just don't understand any plausible view that makes Data the epitome of human nature.
Well, I would say, I guess there's a sort of tension around, or an ambiguity around Data in a sense, isn't there? Because on the one level, he embodies a lot of very positive, aspirational human qualities. He's very decent. He has a strong sense of right and wrong. He's very considerate. He's, you know, and his own aspirations are in very positive directions. You know, he wants to be human. I think, doesn't Picard say even in Nemesis, in his search for becoming more human, he made us understand more about humanity, something along those lines. And I think there's an aspect of that is that he in the show is kind of adding to the currency of Picard and Picard's humanism in a sense, purely by constantly, you know, wanting to be more like that. On the other hand, I mean, you know, Data, you could say he's more advanced. He is, you know, from a kind of, from a Vulcan perspective, he is better than a human being. But on the other hand, he lacks certain things. He lacks a kind of understanding of nuance. He lacks, you know, he's often misunderstanding things. He doesn't understand emotions. He doesn't, you know, there's an element of, Brent Spiner said he used to get letters from people who suffered from Asperger's or autism or so on. There's an element of that. He doesn't really understand human emotions in other people. I mean, even in Generations, he shoves Dr. Crusher over the side of the ship because he doesn't understand about humor and context and so on. So there is a kind of, and in that sense, I suppose he is a bit like a machine. And if you think in the real world of, you know, something like the Turing test, is it possible for a machine to convince a human being that it is human? And, you know, you have those kind of, I mean, even, I don't know, a couple of decades ago, you'd have those kind of online chat program type things that would, chatbots, yeah, exactly, right? Chatbots. Yeah. But it probably is exactly that kind of lack of contextual understanding of speaking to another similar being that is where those things fall down, and that is where you're going to realize, actually, I am speaking to a machine and not a person, because they don't understand the nuance of something. They don't understand the humor, or even if you're being sarcastic, they might not pick up on that. It's that kind of thing. And I suppose when you're looking at the relationship between humans and machines, which in Star Trek often is an area of debate, you know, we have the situation in The Measure of Man. What is the machine? What is the status of the machine? Is it kind of a person? Is it human, etc.? That's another branch of human exceptionalism. And it kind of, it cuts both ways, because it gets questioned, you know, Data's just a machine. The Doctor is just a hologram. Janeway consistently says for a long time in Voyager, he's just a hologram. He's just a hologram. And that use of that word just is very loaded, because it, that is an exceptionalist position being voiced in that word, in a sense. It's saying, I am something more than whatever that thing is. You know, Data isn't it. Yeah, I'm
merely
a
hologram.
And of course, again and again, what we see in Star Trek is this kind of humanization of the machine entities, or of the holographic entities or whatever, where we realize that they're not just whatever we said they were just. They're part of what we are. They're kind of welcomed into the fold. And it's no coincidence in The Measure of a Man, you know, you have this analogy with slavery. It's exactly the same thing that happened in the real world with slaves, with, you know, black people that were encountered in other countries by the white kind of colonialist travellers. They were dehumanised. That's the danger of exceptionalism, is that you dehumanise other beings that should be treated on an equal level with yourself. You know, you think, I'm the white European, I'm exceptional. The black African is not of my order. They're of the order of the rest of the world around me, all these animals and so on. So you literally dehumanize those people. And obviously that's the situation that Data is in until he is granted, obviously not being human in a literal sense, but in a kind of metaphorical sense, that is really what's going on, because he's being treated as a person and not a thing. And, you know, for us as humans, we do tend to, I mean, there's another whole question about whether we should be allowed to think of animals as things rather than as beings. But, you know, that is the kind of underpinning of human society these days, is that human beings are people and other animals around the world are treated as property.
I'm thinking of the episode in Theory in which we really see the limitations of Data's programming. You mentioned previously, Duncan, that he doesn't understand the nature of relationships, emotions. These are concepts that are beyond his grasp. And I love it that he kind of goes around the ship and he asks advice. Worf says, you know, we don't pursue relationships. Klingons conquer, you know, what they want. And I think probably the best answer that he received was from Captain Picard, in which he said, I'd be delighted to offer some advice. He said, you know, about understanding women. And when I have some, I'll let you know.
Well, I think, Mike, from a Turing test standpoint, Data's not very, he's not a very good candidate for passing the Turing test, right? He's very clunky with language. He's socially awkward. I don't think he's a plausible Turing test candidate. Lore is actually much better at this. I think Lore would be a much better candidate for passing the Turing test than Data. Tasha Yar might think Data is fully functional. When you turn out the lights, maybe you can't tell the difference. But
maybe emotionally functional.
The thing that Data has in my mind is kind of this Socratic wisdom, knowing what he doesn't know. He knows he doesn't fit in, and he knows he doesn't use language correctly all the time, and he knows he has a lot to learn, and he's on this quest. And this Socratic wisdom is part of Data, part of the appeal of Data, part of the reason he's a lovable character. You know, he develops, of course, over time, but I don't think it's not because he's the best, most human-like android out there.
Right. Well, my point, Zachary, is that I think at the end of the day, it's his quest to pursue humanity that makes him in some respect superior, because he recognizes his own limitations and yet he tries to transcend them. And I think that's a picture really of the Federation. I think that's a picture of humanity for that matter. We recognize our limitations and we strive to transcend them. And I think at the end of the day, that's, if there's anything exceptional about humanity, that's it.
Well, any one of those factors we've talked about would be a reason for humans to stay on Earth and not get out there in the galaxy, right? And the Vulcans basically say as much to the humans at the beginning of Enterprise. They basically say, you're not ready, you know, stay, you know, we're not going to give you this technology. You know, you have a ways to go from a developmental standpoint. And humans are like, yeah, we know all those things. We know we're not perfect. We know we have a lot to learn. But we're going to go out there and try to do some good and see what we can learn and see who we can form relationships with. And I think, being aware of your limitations, I mean, certainly not every human does this, right? There are a lot of people who are not aware of their own limitations, for sure. So I don't think that's an essential part of humanity, but it's one of our better qualities, I think. You know, when we're at our best, we know what we're good at and we know what we have yet to learn.
And it's certainly in Star Trek something that is, if not unique to humans, it contrasts with most of the other species that we are familiar with on a kind of ongoing basis. I mean, I was thinking, first of all, you know, what we were just talking about, you know, Picard says in First Contact, we work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity. That's his view of human beings and the Federation more generally. That is also precisely what Data is doing on a kind of personal level. I suppose the other quality that differentiates humans, I mean, we talked previously about this kind of moral quality of compassion. The other thing is they're explorers. You know, their mission is to seek out new life and new civilizations. That's the reason they're out in space. They're exploring. They're learning about space. They're learning about themselves. You know, as Q points out at the end of The Next Generation, they're learning about what it means to be human. They're learning about the parameters of human experience and so on as well. And really, none of the other main species that we see in Star Trek, that's not what they're doing there. You know, they're defending their empires. If they're Klingons, they're seeking glory in battle. If they're Ferengi, they're seeking, you know, business in the Gamma Quadrant. They're not exploring the Gamma Quadrant to see what's out there. They're exploring it to see where they can make money. If they're Romulans, they're kind of policing their territory in a sense and ensuring their own borders are secure and so on. So there is a real sense that the humans, I think, are unique in that sense, in that their whole motivation for being in space is this kind of quite noble ideal of exploration, of, you know, seeking out what's, you know, on this frontier, finding out the unknown. There's this kind of curiosity and this fascination with what's out there that really you don't, generally speaking, see from the other species.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier the audio clips at the beginning of our show. We have, you know, have Captain Sisko saying there's room for all philosophies on this station, but we also have Captain Picard saying there's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy. And I think I'm the first to say that I think the early seasons of The Next Generation just do not get the credit they deserve from a philosophical standpoint. In fact, even here on Metatrex, we haven't dwelled on them as much as I would like. We need to do a few more episodes on some of the things that come up in those early seasons of TNG. But there's an interesting tension between going out into the galaxy to explore. Because, I mean, even the Spanish conquistadors were explorers, right? I mean, you can explore with a great many other motivations in mind than these pure, lofty, noble knowledge or wisdom-based ideas. And here we have Captain Picard, who's the quintessential explorer. I mean, he is captain of the Federation's flagship, you know, and they're not just doing diplomacy, they're doing scientific exploration. He's on the frontier, supposed to be, you know, on the frontier of what the Federation's mission is. And yet here he is in a shuttlecraft with Wesley Crusher saying, you know, all of that is important, but philosophy is more important than that. There's no greater challenge than that. It's more challenging than exploring the galaxies to turn your mind inward and explore the human condition, or explore knowledge, or explore things in this very abstract, you know, idealistic, mental, philosophical sense. And that's an interesting tension, because you could imagine other Federation captains who are not philosophical, that are just out there exploring. They could be perfectly fine members of the Federation, perfectly good Starfleet captains, but not be tempered by wisdom. And I kind of think of human nature as having these Aristotelian qualities. You know, finding the middle ground between any one of these extremes, right? If you're just an explorer, but you're not philosophical, you run the risk of being a conquistador. If you're too logical and not emotional enough, you run the risk of being cold. Or if you're too emotional, you run the risk of being irrational. And, you know, Star Trek definitely, I think, has this Aristotelian middle ground, golden mean sense of humanity that humans are good at finding the balance among these competing qualities and these competing extremes. But all of it is tempered by this reflective, you know, it's not just knowledge and exploration for its own sake. It's knowledge and exploration because it adds something to the human condition, and we learn something philosophical about it. It's not just exploring for its own sake, I think. I don't know what to make of that. I just feel like it's the paradox of Captain Picard, who is the explorer, saying that's not as challenging as studying philosophy is a fascinating tension to me.
Well, I suppose in The Next Generation, you have, you know, there's the external exploration that's going on with the ship. Although, to be honest, I mean, a lot of the time in The Next Generation,
they're just ferrying diplomats.
They're not really exploring the new. Exactly. They're dealing with a situation that's already understood, or they've been told go to this planet because they're having a problem with this thing. So in a sense, they're not. I mean, arguably, Janeway is doing more exploring, you know, in the kind of line of Kirk than Picard is. On the other hand, there is this kind of constant exploration on a more local level. You know, you think of Picard, he spends a lot of time in his ready room or in his quarters, you know, reading Shakespeare, experiencing other cultures, you know, helping Data out on the holodeck, performing at a Christmas carol, or, you know, these kind of life-enriching
classical music
activities.
Intent forward, yeah.
Exactly, classical music, writing poetry. You know, this is a ship where everyone is in this kind of constant self-improvement program, in a sense. That's almost what it seems to mean to be on the Enterprise D, and it's not even purely recreational. I mean, if you think of Voyager, people on Voyager, they're more often, they're in their Polynesian style resort, or they're kind of playing pool, or they're, you know, they know how to have a good time and to relax. But the Enterprise D is very kind of you know, cultured and sort of sophisticated, and everything is improving in one way or another. You know, there's this kind of drive towards self-improvement, which obviously, you know, you see in both Picard and Data.
Well, in a technological society, there's the danger of losing some of those more human liberal arts kind of traits, right? I mean, you know, we can be so obsessed with our iPhones or our computers or our factories that we forget to take time for leisure and time for art and whatnot. And I just love that they, you know, it's very stereotypical. Like it's not fun art. It's classic art. It's not fun music. Yeah. it's playing Vivaldi in 10 forward, right?
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
You know, Next Generation has a very weird take on this. I think Voyager did this a lot better. When they have fun on Voyager, they have a lot more fun on Voyager and Deep Space Nine as well. But I think generally they're making this claim that there's a danger in this technological progressiveness that we lose this more artistic expression that defines humanity as well. And if we're talking about exceptionalism, that's something that humans do compared to other species on this planet, at least. We have, you know, myriad artistic forms of artistic expression that other species on this planet don't seem to have. And that is does seem to be something unique that we have. So I like that the Next Generation is, you know, just sort of making this claim that we don't want to lose that essence of that part of our essence in this progressiveness.
I find that fascinating because very early on, the Enterprise D very much reminds me of the Platonians from the original series and the way they kind of leisurely stroll around. They leisurely stroll around the ship and they pursue their hobbies and arts. And don't get me wrong, I think that's great. But I have to agree, Zachary, and you know, certainly that's just one more notch for you on why Voyager is a little bit better at this, because they're able to explore the galaxy and they have their focus on a mission and on that sense of exploration, but they can always go to the holodeck and let their hair down, put their grass skirt on and hula with the rest of them.
Well, it's hard to imagine though, in terms of this kind of, the kind of culture that goes on the Enterprise D, you couldn't really imagine any. You wouldn't think of a Cardassian or a Klingon ship going past, and the you know Cardassian version of Dr. Crusher is directing a play, or the you know Klingon version of you know Data.
I can see Worf putting on an opera,
you know,
though.
Performing. Yeah, Worf might, but I can't really imagine. Do you really think the rest of the Klingons would bother? They just go to their mess hall and get drunk, wouldn't they? You know, it's kind of, I can't imagine the degree of effort that's part of it. The crew on the Enterprise D, their leisure activities are quite labor intensive compared to, you know, these other situations on Voyager or Deep Space Nine or so on, which are more kind of genuinely about recreation.
I can't see Martok teaching a, you know, cooking targ class or anything like that, certainly.
No, exactly.
But I do like the fact that even in TNG, we learn that the Klingons like opera, Klingon opera, right? So, you know, it's not that, I mean, we don't explore it very much, but the mere fact that a species as warlike as the Klingons have this artistic, cultural, frankly, romantic sense, you know, Klingon. And maybe, of course, we know Worf over-romanticizes everything about being Klingon. But, you know, the mere fact that there is Klingon opera says something about the cultural similarity of humans and Klingons, even despite this difference in temperament and difference in their essential nature. It's easy to oversimplify, and we very seldom get to do a deep cultural exploration of some of these more, what I would think of as more human-like qualities of the alien races we see in Star Trek. I enjoy when it happens, but it doesn't happen very much.
It often feels like it's slightly just sketching something out in a very kind of broad way. I mean, there's an episode of Deep Space Nine where Garak talks a bit about Cardassian crime fiction, but it just seems, I don't know, it's hard to quite buy into it. On the other hand, I thought that in Darmok, they do quite a good job of conveying, I suppose because that's the only thing that they can really convey about this alien culture, you do believe that behind these kind of phrases that are being repeated again and again, there is a kind of rich cultural history to that planet. Do you know what I mean? It kind of, I feel like as a viewer, you sort of buy into that. You kind of believe that these stories exist and that they are a meaningful part of that culture. To probably, for me anyway, there's something about the kind of Klingon stories and the Klingon opera and all that stuff. I don't know. On some level, I slightly don't buy it, I think. And I don't really buy the kind of the Cardassian culture and so on. But somehow that story in Darmok, that is a... It feels real, and it's also an episode in which you have these two cultures and they're being treated very equally because of the kind of situation of the episode, because these two captains have been put in these very sort of equal and opposite positions.
Yeah, it's almost like
explain themselves on equal terms.
It's a state of nature. It's almost like a Hobbesian state of nature, right? These two people stripped away of all their society, stripped away of all their resources, you know, as equals, potentially at war with each other. We don't really know what the situation is until the episode unfolds and learn they end up having to cooperate and whatnot. But, you know, the stripped away of societies, individuals look a lot more equal once you remove all of this cultural baggage that they carry around with them in normal environments.
And it's a very unexceptionalist story in a sense, because it isn't about the humans being superior, or I mean in a sense Darmok is a kind of retread of Arena, isn't it? And in a way with Kirk and the Gorn, we kind of assume the Gorn would have killed Kirk if he'd been in Kirk's position. Kirk, of course, displays this kind of signature human compassion and doesn't kill the Gorn. So he kind of proves that he's best in a way. He kind of wins the fight on a moral level as well as on a kind of physical level. But I don't think with Picard and the Temarian captain that there is that sense. It does seem very much they both are fully realised, complex characters. You feel that both their cultures are able to meet in the middle, that there is a kind of equivalence between the stories that they're telling and the kind of world behind all of that. So I think that's an interesting example in a way of an episode where Star Trek doesn't take this kind of exceptionalist view, and it really does engage with an alien culture on equal terms.
And I love the fact that the sort of cultural bridge that Captain Picard finds, the way he learns to start communicating with the other captain, is to tell the epic of Gilgamesh, right? And this says something about what's important about being a captain. It's not just about starship operations. It's not just about being an explorer. But if Captain Picard didn't have this rich cultural knowledge, he wouldn't be able to form that bound. And I think that's an important part of human nature. I think it distinguishes us from other beings on this planet. And it might be the thing that allows us to form other relationships out in the galaxy. You know, we can share stories with each other, but they're not just, you know, how do I run my starship? It's cultural and it's artistic and it means something. And that meaning might be what can transcend this cultural divide.
What I appreciate, I think, about that is the fact that Captain Picard wasn't trying to bring the other captain to his level or to his place, but rather met him where he was. I know some of the darker chapters of human history are chapters in which cultures went in and forced change in other cultures. I'm thinking about African cultures, even South American cultures, for that matter, in the history of the United States, you know, trying to affect change among Native Americans, in which, you know, we feel that we've achieved something by, you know, teaching them to wear Western clothing and speak English, and ignoring the fact that they have these deep, rich elements of their own culture and their own identity. I appreciate that about Star Trek The Next Generation, that they were able to recognize that. And you don't see the Federation, at least in the run of the series, you don't really see the Federation pursuing that type of mission as they explore the galaxy.
Well, I guess this is the heart of my earlier question. Can you have that kind of cultural assimilation, helping other groups of people progress towards some ideal without demolishing their culture outright, without, you know,
sure,
would there have been a better way to learn to interact with, I mean, Native Americans are a great example. Would there have been a better way to learn to develop together as a society or societies without dehumanizing them, without, as you say, making them wear pants, right?
Or however Western you clothing, put it,
right?
Yeah.
Western clothing, right? Would there have been, you know, what's the middle ground there? I mean, option one is just don't engage at all, let them be their own society. Option two would be, you know, what did in fact happen, which is this massive cultural assimilation, just the destroying of their culture, essentially, more or less. You know, what's the healthy middle ground between those two extremes?
Well, and it's an interesting subject to kind of come around to, because, of course, we're talking about exceptionalism. In the real world, the term exceptionalism is very heavily associated with American exceptionalism, you know, going right back to the kind of, I was going to say the founding of America, the pre-founding of America. You know, the first settlers in America had this idea that they were on a kind of on a mission, you know, and this kind of idea of
manifest
in
destiny,
Star Trek,
as they
you
called
see
it. Yeah.
Manifest destiny. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in Star Trek, you have something very similar for the humans. You know, there is this sense that their destiny is in space. I mean, life on Earth is nice and, you know, it's very comfortable. But really, if you want anything meaningful to happen in your life, you need to get on a spaceship and go out and explore. And there's definitely that exact feeling, kind of manifest destiny, which in Star Trek is about exploring space. And there is, you know, we talked a bit about this colonial anxiety. There is a darker side to exceptionalism, you know, which we've touched on when we sort of talked about slavery and dehumanization and so on. But it's also it's something that's kind of tied into it, because whenever you feel that you are different from others, there's a danger in terms of how you're then going to treat those other people. And, you know, that is something that happened, obviously, with the Native Americans and the settlers in America. And it's kind of tied up with that idea of being on this kind of almost divinely ordained mission, on this kind of, you know, having this destiny in the world that makes you special. And in Star Trek, we see the dangers of that, I suppose, sometimes in encountering other species who also think they're exceptional. I mean, I'm thinking in Enterprise, for example, you have the Trianon, the suicide bombers, basically, who, you know, they think they're on a religious mission. They think they're better than everyone else, in a sense. And what it leads to is, you know, a devaluation of a human or any life, really, because they think they're kind of better than anyone else. You see it as well with Paxton, obviously, in Enterprise, who is a real, you know, you talk about human exceptionalism. He is the ultimate human exceptionalist. He thinks humans are better than all these other species. He thinks humans should not interbreed with these other species. And he has this very, he has a complete confidence in manifest destiny, in a sense. He has this vision of humans going out and taming the universe. That's the word he uses, taming it with human hands. And it's very much this idea of we are special. We are these kind of, you know, anointed people who are going to go out and shape the world in our image or to our own desires or, you know, the way that we want it to be. And obviously, we see repeatedly these ideas are dangerous because there's always someone who's going to be on the other side of that, and they're not going to come out of it very well.
It would be very easy for a Starfleet captain to take the power of his or her starship and go on a quest to, you know, make civilized the uncivilized people he encounters, to attack the things he doesn't agree with. And generally, Starfleet captains are really good at restraining themselves about that. There are some exceptions. I'm thinking of people like Captain Ben Maxwell, the Starship Phoenix that we see in The Wounded in The Next Generation. He basically takes his starship on a personal quest, attacking Cardassian vessels and whatnot. But generally, there are guardrails in place, right? Starfleet captains have a lot of power at their disposal. In fact, even in that episode, the Cardassian captain says there's a huge arsenal at Captain Maxwell's command, right? And there is. And what do you do when you have a huge arsenal at their command? And in the real world, we have that. We have, you know, presidents of countries that have their finger on the button of a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons. This is a realistic situation. So what do you do in that situation? Well, you put guardrails in place. You have accountability. You have division of power. You form healthy relationships with other societies. There's a whole host of things you can do to prevent that abuse of that type of power. And I think the Federation, you know, plausibly has a lot of those guardrails in place, even despite the huge arsenal of command at the arsenal, the command of Federation or Starfleet captains.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the film Insurrection was originally, I don't know if you've read Michael Piller's book, which I think has now been published. I read it when it was just online, but, you know, there's a lot of information there about the kind of creative process that went into developing that story. And at one point the tag that it was kind of, or the pitch that was associated with it, was a Heart of Lightness story. So it was basically a kind of riff on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but in the vein of something a bit more comic. And there was exactly that kind of idea, which does kind of bleed through into the film with Data, I think, because, you know, because he ends up basically, you know, just working on this kind of ethical impulse, in a sense, that he's sort of interfering with the with the culture, which they think of as a primitive culture. And I think there was, in one of these early drafts, this idea of this Starfleet captain who was an old Academy friend of Picard's, who'd sort of gone into that role and gone into slightly the kind of Kurtz role in Heart of Darkness of, you know, sort of setting himself up in this certain position with regard to the species on the planet or the natives or whatever. I think in terms of what you were saying, Zachary, about that it's possible to have that there's the kind of good exceptionalism and the bad exceptionalism. Obviously, that's true. It's true in Star Trek. Anyone would rather live in the Federation than, you know, in the Cardassian Union or probably, you know, in the Klingons or the Ferengi or whatever. You know, we would rather live on Earth or live under Federation law. It's clearly a better society for its members, and in a sort of principled sense, in the same way as, yeah, of course, you know, our sort of current liberal democracies are better than fascism or, you know, etc. Or, you know, even in the present day, we would say it's much better to live in America than to live in North Korea. But I suppose there is a danger that, you know, maybe is touched on a little bit in Star Trek, that what is the line between kind of exceptionalism and chauvinism? You know, when does it become, even if it's not about a kind of abusive relationship or an exploitative relationship, that is there this kind of danger in this kind of understood sense of superiority? One of the things it makes me think of in terms of the kind of real world current context, you know, we were talking about American exceptionalism, is, I don't know if you've seen the TV show The Newsroom, the Aaron Sorkin show, the very first episode of that, the kind of key sort of iconic scene really is that the main character, who's this kind of news anchor, is asked in a panel discussion, why is America the greatest country in the world? And everyone else on the panel gives these various reasons why they say that's the case. And he very controversially says it isn't. And he goes through this whole list of reasons why other countries are, you know, have better educational system or a better system of this or that or the other, basically. And I suppose the argument there is that it's not necessarily that this kind of orthodoxy that America is the best country in the world, you know, which continues today. I mean, if you look at the current presidential election, the Republican platform, American exceptionalism is a part of that platform. And it's not necessarily just the Republicans, because, you know, Michelle Obama's speeches also touch on that, this idea that America is the greatest country in the world. But I think really what that show, The Newsroom, was saying, or what this speech was saying anyway, was that having that attitude is limiting to a certain extent, because you feel complacent, and that maybe it's better to say, look, maybe we're not as good in this area as this thing, or maybe we could aspire to this, or maybe we could aspire to that. So I suppose what we're coming back to again is this idea of aspiration. And one of the things that we've said, you know, in this conversation that's exceptional about the Federation, about the humans, about Picard and Data and so on, is this idea of wanting to be better, of wanting to improve ourselves and so on. And I suppose the danger is if you believe that you're already qualitatively different from everyone else and essentially better than everyone else, then maybe that that drive is going to be slightly suppressed, because you feel you've already reached the point that you were, you know, that you should be going for. And maybe it's this idea, you know, Q says at the end of The Next Generation, there's this exploration of existence. We see it even in the original series in A Mock Time, Spock talking about the difference between wanting a thing and having a thing, that idea of sort of the quest and trying to the journey. You know, if you look at Voyager, to the journey, that's what it's about. It's not about the destination, it's not about the end point, it's not about whether you've reached it already. It's about that kind of movement towards the ideal. And in a way, once you decide that you've already reached it, there's a danger that you're kind of there's nowhere else to go.
So Duncan, I'm currently reading this book called The Cry for Myth by an author named Rollo May. And this is not an author I was familiar with. He's a psychologist with a, you know, most of his work seems to be centered on therapeutic treatments and whatnot. This one I found interesting. He basically makes the claim in the book that societies throughout history have needed their myths that they tell about themselves, the stories and the guiding principles and the heroes and the narratives that define who they are as a people. And that in the 20th century, we've seen a collapse of these myths that we tell about ourselves. Certainly we tend to write things off as mere mythology, right? Mere myths, things that are false almost by definition, as if myths aren't true. But he makes the point that basically we're going to make up our own myths about ourselves. Societies will make up their own myths. Individuals will tell stories about themselves and their identity and who they are. And this causes a lot of, the collapse of myth can cause a lot of, angst for a society, right? As you cease having an identity of who you are, it can cause angst for you as an individual if you don't have a sense of who you are and how you fit in society and how you relate to other people and what track you're on. And I think the role of these guiding principles we've been talking about, whether they're the American Constitution or whether they're the Federation Charter, they serve to define who you are as a people, right? So they're sort of necessary from a societal standpoint. We need something to strive for, something that defines who we are. And then the question is, what happens when you lose crisis, lose faith in your ideals? What happens when those myths get disillusioned, whether it's Section 31, whether it's being in a different environment like we see in Voyager? What should our attitude be? Should it be to dismantle the myths and to say, these principles aren't principles anymore? They're human constructions, or they are not true, or they're impossible to reach, or they're just as good as other people's stories. What happens when you have a crisis of faith in your own narratives, your own principles? I don't have an answer to that, but I feel like those ideals are necessary. It's hard to imagine a dyed-in-the-wool, totally consistent relativist / someone who doesn't hold any myths or hold any ideals. It's just not a very consistent position. You see this among Star Trek fans. I have no doubt that there are listeners on Trek FM who are like this. They have a very relativistic view, kind of a romantic view of the worldview you get in Star Trek, tolerance and whatnot. And then when push comes to shove, they actually get kind of militant about those things. that those become the ideals that they strive for. So they're not neutral. Those have just become the new ideals for them. So, what do you do in that situation? I mean, do we need these ideals? And even if we can't meet them, even if you get disillusioned, even if you have a crisis of faith in them, even if you encounter other societies that don't have them, I can't imagine that dismantling the myths or dismantling the ideals is the right solution to that. That just doesn't feel like the right solution to me. I think we need them from a societal standpoint. Again, philosophically, I feel like some ideals are just better than others. So I doubly don't think that's the right thing to do. But especially since given in the Star Trek worldview, and the Federation is just not neutral about these things. It does have a view that all societies can come together, and that's part of their narrative, and that's part of their ideal. And you wouldn't want to dismantle that. So what do you think about that? I mean, I think ideals are necessary, and I feel like some are better than others. And I can't imagine that just knocking the ideals down a peg is the right answer.
Definitely. No, I think that's true. And I suppose, one way of looking at Star Trek is it does fulfill that role for many people. Obviously this is not true for everyone watching Star Trek, and it's not true, I think, for the two of you. But, historically, in a lot of cultures, religious belief and religious stories have had those kind of roles, whether that's as a kind of moral touchstone or a kind of belief system about the universe, and indeed about the future of the society, those people in that society, and even, going beyond death, the future. You know, what can we expect moving, what is our past? How does that define us? And what do we expect moving forward? Star Trek, in essence, I suppose, I would say, is a kind of secularized, has a role as a kind of secularized myth that anyone can buy into. You don't have to have a particular religious or cultural background to buy into that. And it does have many of those qualities. It does have stories that are, morality plays, or that kind of suggest a certain way of being. It has a lot of aspirational ideas in there that people can, attach themselves to. And I mean, one of the things that we've talked a bit about, how from the sort of, after Gene Roddenberry's death, from Deep Space Nine onwards, and also going into Enterprise, there was a sort of dismantling of some of those myths, particularly the myths that were very prevalent in The Next Generation, which was, in a sense, Gene Roddenberry's kind of second draft, I suppose, he saw it. You know, this was where he'd become much more. He'd drunk the Kool-Aid by that point. He was completely committed to this idea that he was laying out a kind of framework for this utopian future.
A charter,
and
almost,
I suppose,
yeah.
After his death. A charter, exactly. And I suppose after his death, the people who took over in various ways did start chipping away at that. And there was always that kind of backlash. I mean, with Enterprise, the third series of Enterprise, which had this kind of real sort of post 9/11 feeling, this real, you know, the kind of mantra of that season was whatever it takes, we'll do whatever it takes. Basically because the stakes were high enough that all these kind of principles were potentially not necessarily thrown out the window, but put on hold. They basically, everything was, could be suspended. And a lot of people had issues with that. I mean, I know that John Billingsley, for example, was very upset as a kind of long-term Star Trek fan with the direction that Star Trek was going in that year, because he said it felt to him like basically our beliefs, our principles, these most cherished things were sort of relative or contingent, or they could be set aside when it was necessary. And I suppose what's interesting, though, is that they managed to find a way out of that. I mean, in that third season of Enterprise, they managed to kind of get themselves out of that sort of relativistic box and come up with a quite an inspiring, sort of inspirational solution to that problem by, you know, through the Degra character, through getting to know him, through kind of making peace with the enemy and so on. And then, you know, to the extent that then by the fourth series of Enterprise, all of that kind of anxiety and baggage and dismantling could kind of be left behind almost. You know, you'd had all that sort of Deep Space Nine being very grim and dark and questioning all these things. Third season of Enterprise, again, sort of questioning these things. But we kind of ended up back in this optimistic position to the extent that they could end that series on a kind of inspirational note, which is almost astonishing. That speech that Archer gives at the end of Terra Prime is, I mean, A, quite out of character for him, because it is this kind of soaring rhetoric, which you don't associate with him at all. He's been this kind of quite folksy, quite sort of ordinary guy kind of captain. And suddenly he has managed to, you know, link into this kind of broader story of this kind of very aspirational future. I suppose the things that we've been talking about, wanting to better yourself, wanting to go out, wanting to forge these meaningful connections, wanting to do something important and good.
And I guess to wrap up the discussion, I feel like the fundamental question as regarding the relationship between ideals and exceptionalism is the presence of an ideal inherently tied to this negative sense of exceptionalism, or is there a way to tie it to a more positive sense of exceptionalism that doesn't lead us down this dark path that we went down in Deep Space Nine or went down in Enterprise or we go down in the real world all too often? But, you know, is there a healthy marriage between ideals and exceptionalism that doesn't go down that path?
As long as it's a kind of question of coming back to it, isn't it? And from the point of view of Star Trek, it is about that kind of finding a way out of that box, or thinking outside the box, or finding a way back to it. It reminds me a little bit of an interview I read with Joe Manosky years ago, talking about the Killing Game, the Voyager episode about the, you know, with the Hirogen as dressed up in Nazi uniforms and so on. He said basically him and Brannon Braga, they had this idea. He said basically the concept underlying this episode was let's all dress up as Nazis and watch some shit blow up. And that was basically their pitch. And then he said, and then they talked about it and they sort of bashed out the story and they ended up having, it ended up with a kind of Star Trek message and it ended up with something positive coming out of it. And I guess that's what, you know, with Enterprise Season 3, there was an anxiety that sort of wasn't happening. And then at the end, they kind of managed to sort of pull that out of the box. So I suppose that's part of the challenge, both for, you know, we were talking about Picard in Symbiosis. He has to do this, getting around the back of the Prime Directive. Janeway has to find a way of kind of marrying these conflicting, you know, principle on the one hand and what's sort of necessary on the other. And for the writers of Star Trek, they have to kind of juggle that as well. And it's kind of, you know, we talked a bit about Roddenberry's box, as Michael Piller called it. You know, his view was very much you sort of work within the box, you accept the constraints, you work within them. But the other approach is to sort of say, we're going to push this as far as we possibly can. And then, you know, we've painted ourselves into a corner, or we've backed ourselves into a different box. And we have to kind of find a way out of that and a way of sort of, you know, making it all right in the end. And I suppose ultimately that's something that does always happen, which is a reassuring myth in itself.
Duncan Barrett, author of Star Trek, The Human Frontier. Duncan, would you like to share with our listeners a little bit about the book, where they can get it, and how they can connect with you on the internet and around social media?
Sure. The book, if you want to read more about the book, there's actually a website up. It's www.StarTrekHumanFrontier.com, and there are links there to buy the book, both in the UK and in the United States. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on the Babel Conference fairly often, or you can follow me on Twitter. My handle there is at Barrett's Books. That's RRETT, like Majel Barrett.
Well, Duncan, it's been a pleasure having you aboard the Starship of Theseus. I just received a hail, and they are ready to receive you back on the USS Britain.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. Transporter Chief, energize.
Well, Mike, that was so much fun having Duncan on the show. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we've been trying to have a reason to get him on the show for quite a while, and it's been hard to coordinate. So it was great to finally have him on.
It was a real pleasure, Zachary. I know I have been reading Star Trek: The Human Frontier, and I can't say enough good things about this book. It's a very fascinating exploration of the human condition, just as Star Trek is. And I do want to say, I know we thanked him in the turbo lift on the way to the transporter room, but Duncan was very gracious in mentioning Trek FM and many of the shows. All of the shows and hosts were mentioned in there, certainly Metatrek's he quoted in the book, and very gracious of him to include the network and include our podcast in Star Trek The Human Frontier. And Zachary, I know Duncan would want to mention that the cover art for Star Trek The Human Frontier was designed by none other than Trek FM's own art director, Aaron Harvey.
Yeah, it's definitely a fascinating book. And what I really appreciate about Duncan's take on Star Trek and the types of discussions that can ensue from Star Trek fandom is the fact that Star Trek is essentially a mirror on the human condition. It forces us, episode by episode, Star Trek forces us to ask questions about who we are and where we're going and what kind of beings we are, what a relationship to each other and other types of beings should be. And it's a really rich book, so I definitely recommend picking it up. And of course, like we mentioned, Duncan is one of our strongest supporters, both of Metatrek's and of Trek FM in general. In his book, Star Trek: The Human Frontier, Duncan basically claims that this new type of fandom that has emerged as a result of social media, since the first edition of the book was published some time ago, this is really something that's come to fruition in the last 10 or 15 years. When we can have transcontinental real-time discussions, we have podcasts, there's new ways of being a fan and interacting that are leading to new types of discussions that people weren't having years ago in Star Trek fandom. And I think Metatrex is a good example of that. The discussions you find in other Trek FM shows are examples of that. And that's a new way of being engaged as a fan and also having a richer palette of discussions than were possible previously about our Star Trek fandom. So definitely check out the book. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You know, Pushing Daisies and Hannibal are two very different shows, but they both have a very strong visual look and a very strong storytelling style and a point of view. And one is quirky and one is darkly quirky and one is whimsically quirky.
Standard Orbit.
Just across the board, it gives you space adventure because they go to the galactic barrier. It gives you the personal dilemma, which is what Star Trek's all about, exploring the human condition. And it gives you just a fun action adventure as well. So just great entertainment.
The 602 Club.
With the idea of putting your faith in a lie, what do you put your faith in, and is it strong enough to hold it? What they're asking Gotham to put their faith in is a lie. And the moment, again, it comes out, it's not going to be good. And that always struck me as something that's going to be really interesting.
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions. And that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can leave us a voicemail, look in the sidebar of the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
And on Facebook, just go to facebook.com/trekfm, and while you're there, be sure to check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you are not busy being an extraordinarily exceptional human being, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can find my flawed self, certainly in the Babel Conference and on Facebook. Facebook's where I'm most active. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not producing Federation recruitment videos, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, likewise, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling, ZacharyFruhling. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And of course, a special shout out and a thank you to our two associate producers for MetaTreks, Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle @MagicDrop5. And K. Elizabeth Janeway. You can find her under the Twitter handle @ChocoWeeble. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.